When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Ask perhaps we should have switched up our intro a bit this week to be a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we don't wear, as this week we bring our first what some might deem to be racy content as we explore, as today's guest says, the, quote, intersections of fashion, culture, and sex work.
In this week's two-part episode, writer, performer, sex worker activist, and headmistress of the New York School of Burlesque, Jo Weldon, joins us to speak about her latest project, What I Wore to Work, a one-woman stage production which is part fashion history lesson and part autobiographical confessional that reveals the little-known history of sex workers as fashion influencers for millennia.
Yes, and we have spoken about this before a little bit in terms of some of how 19th century elite courtesans patronized the hallowed halls of haute couture. We will mention this again very briefly in this episode as well, but in part one of this episode, we dig back even further in time to the brothel workers of ancient Greece and fast forward all the way to contemporary sex worker style as seen on the red carpet at even this year's most recent Met Gala.
And Dress listeners, while there is no description of sexual acts in any way, please note that there is frank discussion of themes some might consider sensitive, including the professions of stripping, prostitution, and some brief mentions of politics and religion. So if this content is not your cup of tea, we get it. So maybe you just sit this week out. But the very real impact, quote unquote, working girls have had on high fashion is undeniable, as we will soon find out.
Some of you might recall Jo first joined us on the podcast in 2018 to discuss her book, Fierce, A History of Leopard Print, and that also, oh, so many years ago, Jo was also my burlesque teacher. She has also written a comprehensive manual on the art of classic and neo-burlesque, and it's entitled The Burlesque Handbook. And we are so happy today that she's back for yet another revealing episode.
Jo, welcome back.
Jo, we are delighted to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for being here for what promises to be the sexiest episode of Dressed yet.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Yes.
Thank you.
And as you very well know, we have been in conversation about having you join us to speak about sex worker style and its historical influence on fashion for some time now, as your work on this subject has evolved and grown. So could you tell us a little bit about how the seeds for this project were first planted and then its germination into its current incarnation?
I've always known it, but it wasn't conscious realization. Everything was sort of sublimated. And I think that probably has a lot to do with being indoctrinated to thinking that sex workers don't have much to contribute to society or culture generally. And the thing is, I've been an activist and I very much know better, but there's still that trace of indoctrination that sort of blocked my realization. And then when I was working on the history of leopard print, I ran across an Urban Dictionary definition of leopard print that says anything that is leopard print can be described as whore, and gave the example of a whore bra. And I'm in the middle of researching leopard print, and I'm already finding all these different interpretations of what it means to be leopard print and seeing all these influences from other cultures that make leopard print so powerful. And I went, wow, dressing like a whore is a really potent concept in people's minds. And then I realized it's a really potent concept in my mind. It's really important to me. It really matters to me. And so I think about the vernacular dressing like a whore, which means someone is too sexily dressed for wherever they are. And then also the actual dressing like a whore that I did to work in the sex industry.
Yeah.
And I started doing the research informally, and then I reached out to the New York Public Library and they gave me a residency. But unfortunately, the beginning of the residency intersected with the beginning of the lockdown for the pandemic.
Where has this research taken us to today?
I've been writing a book, and right now the book is being edited down. There's way too much. So I'm using that in my Substack and in these little booklets I'm making. But while I was working on the book, I decided to make it into a one-woman show because there was conflict in my mind about whether I should do a third-person version of the history or overview of sex work intersecting with fashion, or whether it needed to be a memoir about what I actually wore to work. And then I got really annoyed when I realized it had to be both. I didn't really want to write a memoir. It's so much easier to do the third-person stuff for me. And it just, I said, I got to do the show. I've got to get this out in front of people and get responses and feedback. And so I put a show together and I started performing it a year ago in New York City. And I'll be taking it on the road in 2025.
Yeah. And it's amazing. I've seen it a couple times now. And one of the things that I love so much about your work and the show in general is how seamlessly you weave together worlds on multiple levels. So on one hand, your one-woman show is funny, sexy, and sometimes it's a little bit explicit. But on the other hand, one should never underestimate like its very real sincerity and scholarship, because I nearly fell out of my chair when at the beginning of the show, you had Johnny come around and distribute your little cards to everyone that had a QR code on it, right? Was it a QR code?
QR code.
Yeah. So people could access your footnotes and all of your scholarly citations that went into the information that you were presenting in your one-woman show. Would you tell us a little bit more about that? I've never seen a stage show that came with footnotes.
I follow a lot of historians. I follow their writing. I read their books. I follow their YouTubes. And I come from a background of studying journalism, and I know what constitutes diligence and fact-checking. And even then, you can sometimes be wrong. Everything I've ever written of any length has at least one error in it, and one error that matters to me. But I do my best. And there is so much weird little history on TikTok and Twitter, and they'll just say something, and I'll realize that's not a fact. That's literally not true, because I've done research in that area. So I wanted to give other fashion scholars, because a lot of fashion designers and scholars have come to the show. I said, if you think this might be interesting for you, or if my perspective is too narrow or too based on my identity characteristics, here's a place to start. Have some fun. Go on, or feel free to fact check me. And I consider anybody that fact checks me or lets me know I have something wrong to be doing me a huge favor. Thank you. But also cite your freaking sources.
Exactly.
Because there's great stuff on every platform, but there is just garbage history out there.
Yeah.
Garbage.
Yeah. If we're going to talk about primary sources and all of the primary sources that went into your work, and especially the show, you begin the show with a doozy. And I didn't see this coming. I don't know if anybody saw this coming as the opening of the show. You open the show with a verse from the Bible. Could you tell us about that verse from Proverbs and why that opens the show?
Yeah. So I decided to set my research in the context of how I would be a person reaching these conclusions. I feel like that's essential, right? And I realized that the first time I ever encountered the concept of dressing like a whore was in the Bible, because I come from a Christian family. There's missionaries and faith healers in my family, and I love them and they've done a lot for me, but they've also terrified me with scary stuff that'll happen to me if I don't study the Bible and get the message. So I studied the Bible and I came away with a completely different message, I think, than they intended. So I first read about whores in the Holy Scripture in some Proverbs, which describe a woman being dressed like a harlot and subtle of heart. So she's crafty. And she leads this young man into sin. And he otherwise would have been sinless his entire life. And it's a warning against women who dress and act seductively. And it describes men who encounter them as utterly powerless in this particular proverb. Like in other sections of the Bible, prostitutes have different powers. But as a kid who was finding the whole Bible unsettling, I was like, oh, here's power. Glamour.
Yep.
When you get to the Whore of Babylon much later in Revelations, and she's described wearing ostentatious purple and red and all this gold jewelry and everything, I was like, oh, she sounds fabulous. I got to get me a seven-headed beast and some red and purple clothes.
And I do believe you were wearing a purple dress the night of the stage show that I saw you. Yeah. I'd also love to give our audience some additional insight into this kind of around the world tour that you give in the show of the history of sex workers' relationship to clothing and style as it dates all the way back to antiquity. Could you talk to us a little bit about some of the laws which governed attire of, let's say, for instance, the brothel workers in ancient Greece, and also the high class courtesans of that time period too, who were known as hetaira, and their influence in actually spawning fashion trends?
Right. So there is definitely what sex workers call a whorearchy in ancient Greece with a lot of different categories of sex workers. And a lot of them were immigrants from Gaul and Germany. And some of them were the spoils of war, women who'd been captured and were enslaved in ancient Greece. And among the hetairae, the blonde hair was highly prized because it was much more common for these people from Gaul and Germany to be blonde than it was for the generally dark-haired Greek. And it was associated with exoticism and eroticism and barbaric animal passions, but also with Aphrodite, the blonde goddess of love, who was something of a patron goddess of prostitutes. So the hetairae would worship her and go to her temple. Whereas the brothel workers were also particularly prized when they were blonde. And some brothels actually required all of their workers to be blonde, whether it was through natural hair color, dye, or wigs. And again, this association with being extremely erotic, exotic, and sexually powerful, of course, trickled up, as fashion so often does, to the wealthy classes, where wealthy women would often imitate these blondes by wearing blonde wigs or dyeing their hair blonde.
And there was a whole actual practice where they had these little sunshade hats that were like a straw ring that went around their heads, and they would apply the bleach and they would sit on the roof of structures to naturally bleach their hair blonde. So like you said, it was that fashion trend was trickling up through society, not down.
Yeah. And they would actually put, the wealthy people would put like gilt powder in their hair, like actual gold powder.
So that's cool.
Also, yeah.
I had never heard that before. That's amazing.
And then the ancient Roman, who took over so many of the characteristics and culturally appropriated from the Greeks, also prized blonde hair in the same way. And there was a Roman moralist who said that the women, the wealthy women who were dyeing their hair blonde, were committing treason by not being satisfied to be good, dark-haired Roman citizens.
There's always a whole handful of the moralists, right?
Yeah.
So also, you and I have been bandying about for a while now different ways to approach this topic as your research expanded. And there for a little while, we were in conversation about maybe just doing an entire episode on the history of the thong. And again, it's surprising to learn that this history dates all the way back to antiquity in terms of the G-string's first association with sex work. So could you tell us, first of all, the difference between a thong and a G-string? I think a lot of people don't know this. And also, what did your research reveal in terms of one particularly notable performer slash personage in ancient Byzantium?
So people definitely use the terms thong and G-string interchangeably. And I understand, and I'm not the kind of person who goes crazy when they call a thong a G-string or vice versa. But there's a difference. So a thong has material on the sides. They both go up between the cheeks of your derriere, but a thong has material on the sides, whereas the G-string has either literally an elastic string or fabric so thin that it's like a string. So a thong has much more structure than a G-string.
Got it. Got it. Thank you. And who in particular do you talk about on the show in terms of maybe that being one of the first examples that you've uncovered in your research?
Yeah, so most of the early examples, and this is all over the world on almost every continent, there's some kind of groin cover for protection against the elements, or commonly in sports, right? And they'd be worn by every gender. But the first example that I found of a sex worker wearing something like a thong or a G-string is the story of Theodora from Byzantium. And I think we're looking at the 5th or 6th century in Byzantium. And the story that Procopius told about her was that when she was young and she was working in the circus as an acrobat and a prostitute, she did an act that was a burlesque of Leda and the Swan, where Zeus comes down and impregnates Leda when he's in the form of a swan. And so, making fun of this, she comes out in beautiful flowing robes, and there's a goose on the stage, and she strips for the goose. She gets down to a thong because they don't allow her to go nude. Of course, politicians are already making sure that they have a say in what the sex workers wear.
And we're going to talk more about that later.
Oh, yeah. And so she's in the thong. She lays down on the stage, and then a stagehand would scatter seed over her crotch, and the goose would come running over to peck at it, and she would writhe as if in agony and ecstasy. And that was the conclusion of this infamous story about her.
And later, if you want to talk about trickling up through society, she ended up becoming the empress.
The Empress of Byzantium, yeah, and an Orthodox saint.
Later on. Cass, did you know that learning a new language isn't only helpful for international travel? Acquiring new language skills also has cognitive benefits and can improve brain function. Studies have shown that learning a new language can improve memory, problem-solving skills, and even delay the onset of dementia.
There are so many reasons to learn a new language, Dress listeners, and Rosetta Stone has been the trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Available to use on a desktop or an app, Rosetta Stone is flexible for when you want to learn fast by immersion.
With features like True Accent that gives you feedback on your pronunciation, to the fact that you get lifetime access to all of Rosetta Stone's 25 languages, this incredible offer solves all your language learning needs for life.
Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Artifact Uprising wants to help you preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want to say I love you with the perfect gift, display favorite memories in your home, or connect with loved ones throughout the year, they have a product you can personalize.
Yes, so many wonderful products, and that even includes baby board books, which is something that I recently personalized for my 2-year-old son, Leo, who loves to read. And I titled the book, A Boy Named Leo. And the best part is that it all comes illustrated with some of my favorite pictures of him by himself and with family and friends. It really is such a sweet, unique, and special commemoration of our life together thus far, and something we will all cherish forever.
Artifact Uprising makes it easy to tell your story. Through the end of the year, Dressed listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use the code DRESSED through December 31st. I think a lot of people will also be very surprised to learn that historically, courtesans, performers, sex workers, Theodora is one good example of this, that oftentimes these women were the most educated and independent in any given society in which they appear. So could you tell us a little bit more about this and maybe a little bit about the legendary courtesans of Venice and their role as cultural influencers?
Yeah, frequently, whether by law or by tradition or by some kind of decree, wives were expected to stay at home and maintain the home and
bear children.
Yeah, even wealthy wives, although you hear about them breaking out all the time. They'll have their way in their blonde wig. These Venetian courtesans are an example of the kind of sex worker that would work their way up because of extreme beauty or cleverness or just being great at interacting with people. And they would become the companion of wealthy men in their leisure time. And leisure time is when people tend to enjoy the arts. So they would often be their companions at functions and intellectual discussions. And they would often be the muses, like statues and representations of myths and stories. But they would also contribute their own opinions, often their own writing. They were often also the entertainment dancers and musicians who carried on the artistic traditions of a culture.
And these societal freedoms and opportunities for self-determination that a lot of these women had were not exclusive only to European sex workers in history. We see it all around the world. Perhaps you could tell us a little more about the courtesans of Edo period Japan and also the Indian Tawaif.
One of the fascinating things is that the platform shoe has a very long history of being associated with sex workers, even when people who were not sex workers were wearing them, because sex workers would be out and about more than most people who were keeping care of the house. And with the Venetian courtesans, you had these very tall, stilt-like platform shoes called chopines. And stilt-like platform shoes, again, on the courtesans of Yoshiwara, which is the brothel district in Edo, Japan, when Tokyo was called Edo. And they have these three-legged platform shoes. And those shoes are so strongly associated with these courtesans known as oiran, that they still do marches in them and they still do processions to celebrate these women in the same three-legged platform shoes and do a very characteristic S-shaped walk. And at the time, they were influencing literature and art. Again, they were singers and dancers. They were often writers themselves. They were the subject of operas, poems, and woodcuts that were distributed widely that, again, affected fashion. They were known for their shoes as well as their extremely elaborate hairstyles and robes. And again, the gaudier, the better, the more lavish and luxe, the better.
Because you're advertising your profession, right? This is a little bit of advertisement that's happening.
Yes, absolutely. They had to stand out. They had to be fabulous. There were prestigious kimono makers who were known for their work with these courtesans. And they were legends in their own time often, although one of the reasons they were popular opera subjects is because their lives were difficult.
So that you have that little bit of like tragedy and gravitas in terms of like literary content. And what about the Indian Tawai?
These were women who they were courtesans, they had houses, and they were dancers, musicians, interior designers, and the arbiters of etiquette for their societies. And of course, when the British occupied this region, we're talking about Mughal India, they occupied this region, and these Tawais were some of the people who organized military actions against the British in movements that eventually got that occupation out. And so the Tawais were really powerful, but they were known for their fashion. They were known for their style, and everybody followed it. And Tawais were also part of the beginnings of cinema in India and are still very popular subjects for Indian cinema. One of my favorites that I read about was Begum Hazrat Mahal, which is a 19th century Tawai. And she led one of these military expeditions against the British. And she's celebrated as a hero now and actually had her own postage stamp in 1984.
A lot of these women made big impacts in their own day. They were celebrities of their day.
Absolutely.
And with the invention of photography, a lot of these women's fame and fashions had international reach. And would you tell us about two celebrated 19th century courtesans that you speak about in the show? And I'm referring to Skittles, just single name there, Skittles, and also Cora Pearl. And what was their relationship to the fashion industry?
Both of them were pretty horse breakers, which was what Victorians called these young women who modeled the wares of carriage makers and stables. And then they would ride in the processions through Hyde Park. So they'd be alongside the wealthy who were showing off their wealth and fashion. And of course, they could come from anywhere as long as they had horseback skills. And they would all also be supplied with lavish clothing. And they became the companions of wealthy and extremely influential men. Mm-hmm. And her name Skittles comes from her working during an early part of her career in a bowling alley. So Skittles is like bowling. And her real name was Catherine Walters, and her house is actually landmarked.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And she became really well known for her incredible riding habits and influenced the fashion of everybody. People would literally riot when she came out to see what she was wearing. And she had an incredibly tiny waist. She was known for wearing her clothing so tight that she couldn't wear underwear. And so she was a known style icon, a big celebrity in her day. Again, known for her lavish lifestyle. Skittles was literally known as the girl with the swan's down seat because she was infamous for having this cushioned toilet seat.
A lot of these women, like Cora Pearl, had very real connections to haute couture as well. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So Cora Pearl was one of the most outrageously dressed women in this circle in London and Paris. And she was known for doing things like dyeing her hair and her dog Blue to match her carriage. And she threw outrageous parties, and she was an activist as well. But she was known for whipping her men harder than her horse. Mm-hmm. She was also a dominatrix.
Yeah. And she was an actress. She was a stage actress at certain points. Yes, as well.
She had moments. Yeah. That was not her primary gig. But yes.
And a lot of these courtesans and stage actresses were major patrons of some of the early couture houses, like House of Worth and also House of Doucet as well. He had ongoing relationships with these stage actresses and very famous courtesans.
Yeah. So Cora Pearl is known for being both a muse and a client of Charles Worth. It's a very significant relationship for both of them. And since so many people talk about Charles Worth as the founder of the modern fashion system, it's interesting to know that there was a sex worker there all along in that atelier making an impact.
Absolutely. And also, a lot of times they had the ability to wear the more outlandish designs from these very established couture houses. So they were really pushing fashion forward, even from the very birth of the haute couture industry.
Yes.
Dress listeners, April here. Find yourself in NYC? Why don't we meet at the Met? On Tuesday mornings and Friday nights, you can join me for a 90-minute around-the-world private group tour of the Met's permanent collection. You will see the Met as never before as we seek out the museum's hidden corners in pursuit of some of the most fashionable artworks in history. From the elaborate beauty rituals of ancient Egypt to the Renaissance fashionistas who cemented the color black as fashion's favorite color for centuries to come, all the way to Edward Manet's depictions of women engaging in the criminal act of wearing pants, this tour unravels the incredible stories behind 10 of the Met's greatest masterpieces. Learn more and register at dressedhistory.com. And also, if you need a different day or time, I can do that too. Can't wait to meet you at the Met. So earlier you mentioned the silver screen, and I want to get back to that because from Victorian photography to the silver screen, sex worker style has really permeated our visual landscape for centuries. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I think that the character's portrayal in movies allows them to fly under the radar a little mm-hmm. bit to media consumers because of the glamour in which and how they are depicted on screen. Once you really start pulling these threads to all of these influences and the connections to high fashion, they start to reveal themselves and you can't unsee it once you see it and think yeah. about some of how your favorite films where this dynamic is actually happening. And it's a feature of the plot. So could you tell us about some of the depictions of sex worker style in film and television and especially maybe some instances which the audience doesn't give too much consideration to at that time?
The ones that were really powerful for me when I was young, because we had all these stacks of Life magazine around, were, for instance, The World of Suzy Wong, which was about a young woman who was doing sex work, and she was wearing a chongsam, which was not unknown to American fashion at that time. But it had a huge impact because the film was an enormous success. The actress Nancy Kwan looked incredible in them and they were styled super sexy. And so it initiated this wave of that silhouette as well as that neckline in fashion. And of course, the most famous example of sex worker fashion on film is also one of the most famous examples of fashion on film, which is Audrey Hepburn in Breakfast at Tiffany's with all her outfits designed by Givenchy.
Yes.
And as you said, sex workers have the opportunity often to wear whatever they want. And people often don't think about the fact that this sex worker character had this enormous impact on both fashion and film. And every now and then people will say, oh, she's not really a sex worker. And like, $50 for the powder room. What do you think? What do you think is happening there? And also, her boyfriend is clearly a gigolo. Clearly. So it's definitely showing that a connection that I think should always be made when people are studying fashion, which is that in cities, fashion is connected to nightlife. And nightlife is full of queer people and sex workers.
Absolutely.
And they are always there. And they are always influential. They help popularize things. They may create things that inspire designers. And I feel like this movie is a great example of how that influence travels, even though, you know, say Givenchy is not designing outfits for most sex workers. They're like, we know of one.
Yeah, absolutely. Right there, 50 foot tall on the screen.
Another favorite of mine, so I'm a kid and I'm not supposed to be seeing some of the magazines I'm seeing, but there was a lot of incredible portrayals of scenes from blaxploitation movies. And in the late 60s, early 70s, I would see these incredibly fashionable women and just be so inspired by what they wore. And there's one movie called Truck Turner, where the dialogue is just, oh God, it's terrible. But the outfits, oh my God. And everything in the movie, all the gowns that they wear to this one funeral, these black cutaway, all these wild gowns, look exactly like the gowns designed by Versace in the 90s. And Versace acknowledged that he was inspired by prostitutes' clothing. So I absolutely loved Clute.
Yes.
And there are no movies from these eras that aren't problematic. So it isn't, oh, yes, it's a perfect example of how sex workers should be portrayed. But it's an amazing movie. And Jane Fonda is so incredibly stylish in that movie. I remember people, I was little, so I must have heard this later, but I remember the shock of her haircut, like people talking about this wild haircut. Jane Fonda was in the middle of a divorce and she wanted a big change, got this shag haircut that then everybody had to have. And she's wearing incredible clothes in the movie, including thigh-high boots, which are practically a trademark in a lot of people's minds of sex workers. Like, they're worn in Pretty Woman. They're worn in so many movies about sex workers. And I wore them as a sex worker. Also, I love that. I love that the costumes were by Anne Roth, who played the beautiful older woman on the bench in the 2023 movie Barbie.
Yes, yes. And when you make this point in the show, everybody in the audience goes, so amazing.
Oh, it gave me chills when I figured it out. I was so amazed and so touched.
Also, Clute had a real impact on contemporary fashion. There's a couple of like more contemporary editorial fashion spreads that I can think of that are using that reference directly in the fashion magazine. So people are influenced by that film.
Yeah, and that turtleneck sequin dress, we've seen so many versions of that.
One of my favorite movies of all time, since I was a kid, is actually Gigi.
Gigi.
And costumes by Cecil Beaton, of course. And I was just obsessed with the way that the movie looked and all of her clothes when I was a kid. And it wasn't until I went back many years later and rewatched it that I realized that they were grooming her to be a courtesan the entire time. That completely flew over my head when I was a child.
Yeah, sex work and fashion on film is a whole topic.
Yeah, this happens again and again. These connections to high fashion jump the shark from portrayal in movies a lot of times and then to the runway in the collections of so many beloved fashion designers. And so many of them have been very candid on this point that sex worker style was their source of inspiration for maybe an entire collections even. And besides Versace, do you have a few other kind of high-end fashion designers that you might like to mention to illustrate this point?
If you look at almost any of them, you'll find examples of them referring to sex workers, naming outfits after famous sex workers, that kind of thing. But I wanted to give a few concrete late 20th century examples. So there's the infamous Scandal collection from Yves Saint Laurent, who also costumed Catherine Deneuve in La Belle du Jour, which is a movie about a sex worker. And
this is what I mean when I'm saying, once you start pulling these threads, you can't unsee it.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Uh-huh. It's everywhere. That's why I'm like, how do I shorten this book? How do I make it? Maybe it's an encyclopedia of fashion and sex work. Yeah. And so there were references to the women on the street in Paris at the time. And it was scandalous because in occupied Paris, a lot of people associated sex workers with complicity. But it's also definitely a reference to sex workers. And Yves Saint Laurent was like, when he received all the criticism, he said, I don't care. This is what young people want. And this is what I want to give to them. It's really an amazing statement. And obviously, Vivienne Westwood. As a kid, I would go to the mall and I would read every rock and roll, punk rock magazine. And there would be pictures of sex, Vivienne Westwood's boutique in London. And they would show people in these outfits where they were like sex workers from the waist down. They were wearing fishnets and garter belts and everything. And then up top, they would have this asymmetrical tops and wild, intimidating makeup and hair. And the juxtaposition of the two was so thoughtful and powerful. I think it really had a lot to do with her original impact. And she had a pair of platform shoes that were like the infamous ones that Naomi Campbell fell off, but they have Mary Jane straps, that were called the prostitute shoes. And you see these influences of sex workers across the eras in her work all the time. And who could be less ashamed about acknowledging that than Vivienne Westwood?
Yeah, who named one of her boutiques Sex.
Yeah, absolutely. And I loved that Patrick Kelly, who's a designer that really touches my heart, had Pat Cleveland dress up like Josephine Baker, who was considered extremely scandalous for her naked dance in a banana skirt. And Pat Cleveland wore the banana skirt on the runway in his show in 1986. He talked about how he loved the glamour of the church ladies, but he's also acknowledging that it isn't all about church ladies. There's some ladies of the night and some naked dancers that have their place too. He was always championing people who were underrecognized for their impact on fashion. And I already mentioned Versace, but Mugler's Follies.
Yes.
Right. So Thierry Mugler. And those were based on follies from the Gilded Age, the 20s, but also modern dominatrixes. And one of Mugler's primary performers in the follies was famous fetish model and burlesque performer named Alada Boutte. And he very openly acknowledged it and always has. And for me, it's been interesting to be in New York and be a sex worker. I've been a stripper and an escort and a dominatrix, among other jobs in the sex industry. And I've always been in nightlife. And I've always seen that nightlife is culture, which means queer people and sex workers are culture because we are nightlife. We are nightlife.
Yeah.
But in New York, I started to realize how many designers were in the room. I can't name check them all because I don't know if it's appropriate, but I know that I can comfortably name without compromising them in any way. I can name Marc Jacobs and Calvin Klein were always there.
Yeah.
And so many other amazing designers. A lot of my companions were associated with Mugler, and you see the fetish fashion in his daily wear that he wore. It's just undeniable that the impact is there, that sex workers are able to popularize styles that might otherwise have been marginalized and force them to trickle up, and that designers are there being inspired by their creativity. Right now, we have major influences like Cardi B, who's very open about acknowledging her history as a stripper and how influential it's been on her style and her life, and Julia Fox, who's very upfront about having been a sex worker, a dominatrix, and how that influenced her sense of style. And I think that's really powerful. And stripper shoes have been seen on the red carpet at the Met Gala on Helen Mirren and Kim Kardashian. When I say stripper shoes, I'm talking about those clear platform heels made by the company Pleasers, but people call them stripper shoes. People know that's the association. And they're worn because they're built for comfort and durability. And they can raise you up 6 to 8 inches. Chopines are back.
Bringing us full circle to 16th century Venice. We're going to end part one here, dress listeners. But don't worry, Joe's going to be back later this week for part two of this discussion, where we're going to get into what she wore to work.
Joe, thank you so much for undressing the longstanding history of sex workers as fashion influencers and style icons, as well as their depictions in film history and the very real impact all of this has had on contemporary fashion today. There are so many things that were exclusively workwear for strippers a few decades ago that are now commonly found on the runway, red carpet, and even in our own closet. These are exactly the sort of hidden histories we love to uncover on Dressed.
Yes, and as Joe mentioned at the top of the episode, she's going to be touring her one-woman stage show, What I Wore to Work, in 2025. And you can stay tuned to her website, which is joweldon.com, and that's W-E-L-D-O-N, to learn more in the coming months for more details on that. And you can also find her book, Fierce, A History of Leopard Print, on our Dressed bookshelf at bookshop.org/shop/dressed.
And I do have to say, Dress listeners, I have been a subscriber to Joe's newsletter, and it is absolutely fantastic. I highly recommend subscribing. And Joe will be back with us later this week to discuss further in detail what she wore to work in her own career as a sex professional. So if you enjoyed this episode, part two really turns up the heat. I think that does it for us today, though, dress listeners. So until Friday, may you consider where you find sex appeal in your wardrobe next time you get dressed.
As always, remember, we love hearing from you. So if you'd like to write to us, you can do so by way of email at hello@dressedhistory.com. DressedHistory.com is also where you can find any and all details about our upcoming classes, trips, and tours. Or you can also DM us on Instagram at Dressed_podcast, which is where we post images to accompany each of our episodes. If you'd like to find the Instagram content specifically related to this episode, you can search the hashtag Dressed #Dressed507. And also for next week's part two, that would be #Dressed507.
Also, did you know you can listen to the show ad-free for just $3 a month? You can subscribe to the exclusive content version of Dressed, which does not have ads. You can find the link in our show notes to do so. Thank you as always for tuning in, and more Dressed coming your way on Friday. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.